Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Yes, that's true.
That is true. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. And as per usual, the number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Just want to slow it down. Sometimes I feel like I say it too fast. If you want to send me an email, you know where to go. But if you don't, it's relevantradio.com/Patrick and click on connect. And then you could send me an email. It comes right to me. I do appreciate it. Thank you for all the emails that come in. And I've got several I'm going to be getting to. First off, Barb, listening in Madison, Wisconsin on 1240 AM, she's sent in a note overnight saying, "Hi, a parishioner called today. I work in the office and said that someone from Planned Parenthood knocked on her door yesterday asking for a donation. She told them to get off her property." Oh, I wish I could have seen that. Get off my property. Barb says they are apparently getting desperate. Longtime listener, Barb. Barb, thank you for listening. I don't know. My first reaction is that might have been a scammer, you know, because I've never heard of Planned Parenthood going door to door. I mean, it may happen, but I've never heard of them doing that. They certainly have other means of getting money, like, you know, from the federal government to the tune of $500 million a year. I'm not so sure they need to go door to door.
Well, you can always tell when they're walking up the walkway.
How do we know that? Oh, yeah. That's true.
Yeah, if you hear that, it's Planned Parenthood, and don't answer the door.
Yeah, because that's the mood music that kind of gets you in the mood to think about what Planned Parenthood does. Let's hear a little bit more of that. Yeah. All right. Yeah, it's hard to listen to, but it's also hard to contemplate Planned Parenthood and what it does. So I'm not so sure, Barb. Maybe that was a for real Planned Parenthood person from a local clinic. Maybe, you know, maybe they're hurting and they sent some people out. But then again, it could also have been one of those scammers. Hey, I'm from Planned Parenthood. Do you support abortion? Hey, give me some money. We'll help with the abortions. Could have been that too. I don't know. But I would love to see them get desperate. I'd like to see them go away. Let's go to the phones. Helen in Phoenix. Good morning and welcome.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Yes, I'm caring for two people in my family who are getting close to the end of life, one very near. And you have spoken at times about what is spiritually honorable and loving and caring for them and recommended a book. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to talk about it again.
I'd be happy to. I'm just racking my brain right now trying to think of what book that might have been. Do you remember any details of what I said? I recommend a lot of books, so I want to make sure.
I don't remember the name of the book, and I wanted to write it down, but I didn't. But if there's any book or website or a phone number, anything that you could recommend about what our responsibilities are and what we don't need to push to, but you know,
okay.
I want to be as loving and caring as possible.
Well, it could be this book, but I don't know. It's a book by Mark Henry called Finish Faithful, and it's a book about end-of-life issues, but it primarily deals with how to avoid or help somebody who's near the end of life, how to help avoid putting into writing certain things that would make that person's life cut short. And it's a variety of things. So durable power of attorney. He goes through several of the things that you would want to have, and he suggests verbiage so that you can have it written a certain way to protect the person who is dying. Certain, like, do not resuscitate orders can be written in a certain way that they might not give any food or water or anything, and we don't want that. So does that sound like the book that I was talking about? Because it's been a while since I mentioned it, but Finish Faithful, that comes to mind.
Between ordinary and extraordinary means, reading on a couple of pro-life sites that feeding tubes and water hydration, even through an IV, are sometimes being called medical treatment rather than basic for now so that right. those can be withheld from persons.
Okay, I think I understand now, Helen.
Does the book that you just mentioned discuss what how to find out if basic care is considered medical treatment or not? Or I'm not sure how. I'm just looking for kind of parameters.
I think I understand. I think I do. So that book does touch upon those things, but only insofar as they deal with how would you want the end of life instructions to be written so that the patient is not taken advantage of. But it has more to do with paperwork and instructions and things like that. I think maybe the book that you heard me talk about more recently is called Life Issues, Medical Choices. And that's a book that has roughly 50 chapters on bioethical issues. And this is one of them, about the end of life and what is considered permissible morally. So in the case of somebody who's on an extraordinary measure for life support, like let's say a ventilator, that you're not doing anything immoral if it gets to the point where there's no hope. And if you unplug the ventilator, you know that the person will die. You're not killing the person because you're not obligated to sustain life indefinitely in an extraordinary way. But it also talks about how basic human necessities like oxygen and food and hydration, you can't deprive somebody of that. It would be immoral to do something like that outside of some of those circumstances in which the body has already begun to shut down. And so there's no ability for the body to absorb, let's say, water, or there's no more ability of the body to absorb food. There are some exceptions to that general principle. But as a general principle, we are obliged in a moral sense to provide those necessities that we all need, food, water, oxygen, etc. Does that sound like maybe the book you're thinking of?
Yes, it does. Could you say the name of the author again for the Life Issues book?
Yeah, so it's two authors, Dr. Janet Smith and Dr. Chris Kazor, and I believe his last name is K-A-C-Z-O-R, and they are moral theologians. They're PhDs, not MDs, but they're deeply knowledgeable in these medical issues. And that's a book that I've read and reread a few times over the years. It's helped me quite a bit. And what I like about it is it will give you clarity in understanding what are the basic moral principles in play in a given situation. So I hope that you find that helpful, Helen. And one last thing, while we're at it, there is a wonderful resource, the National Catholic Bioethics Center. They're located just outside of Philadelphia. And their website, if you want to jot this down, is ncbcenter.org. ncbcenter.org stands for National Catholic Bioethics Center. And they have a whole end-of-life section with a lot of free materials, PDFs of guides on how these, you know, living wills and do not resuscitate orders and durable powers of attorney and other things, how those should be worded and other things beyond that, that I think you'll find very helpful as well. So check it out. Thanks, Helen. Let's go now to Joseph in St. Louis. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Joseph. Hey, good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. I know we talked a couple days earlier. You recommended me to watch some videos from Aquinas 101.
Yeah.
So I did. I watched the one on faith and evidence. That one was really informative. Mm-hmm. And before I get to my question, really brief, I want to make just a quick comment. So it was saying that the faith, you know, supernatural faith, it's not a probabilistic judgment. It's not an act of philosophical knowledge. And it's not directly because of confirmatory signs or miracles. Like, those corroborate, but it's not directly because of them. And so that brings me to my question.
Right.
My question is, why isn't faith any of those things? Like, I know there's Ephesians 2 that says, you know, faith is a gift from God. It's not from man, lest we boast. But it just kind of seems like we make decisions like that all the time. Like, we go from evidence then to belief. And I had done that, you know, a lot since eighth grade, actually, just because, you know, I had a religious experience in eighth grade where I felt like I encountered God for the first time. And it's like, when I hear this, you know, am I not supposed to believe? Because I've always believed because of that event, in eighth grade that, oh, God must be real. He must love me. So,
yeah, I have a few thoughts on
that. Does that kind of make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a few thoughts on that. So what the good Dominican friars are saying in that in the Aquinas 101 videos, and far be it for me to try to improve upon what they do, but I'll try to interpret it here, is to point out that your knowledge, your powers of reason and arriving at the truth through logic and evidence, etc., if that were sufficient in itself, then there would have been no need for Christ to become incarnate. There would have been no need for the divine revelation that's imparted to us. We could save ourselves, in other words. We could arrive at these conclusions on our own power. But the fact of the matter is we can't. So with the starting point that we can't save ourselves, our knowledge or the faith that we might have based upon the evidence is insufficient for us to be saved. So that's where faith as a supernatural virtue comes in. And this is not something that's added to what we already know. And it is true that very often people do come to faith in Jesus, or they may have faith in Jesus, but they come to the realization that, oh, the Catholic Church is the church he established. And it may be through a long chain of evidence that they wind up arriving at that conclusion. So this is not to say that you can't arrive at that point with evidence drawing you, and then faith completes the picture, but rather that faith in and of itself is sufficient. Even if there were no evidence, there is plenty of evidence, but even if there weren't, our faith in Christ is not based upon the evidence. The evidence supports our faith and shows us the reasonableness of this faith. And an example that comes to my mind, Joseph, would be the good thief on the cross. So there he is, nailed to a cross, bloody, dying, next to another man who's nailed to a cross, bloody and dying. There's really no evidence there from Jesus dying on the cross that would move him to say, oh, you know what? This is the Son of God. I'm going to believe in him. So in the extremity of his life, where there was really no evidence that is told to us in the Bible anyway, yet he comes to faith. He has this supernatural moment of realization given to him by God that this is Jesus, this is the Messiah, and he has faith in him and he dies and is saved. So I could use him maybe as an example of what the Dominicans are suggesting. Not that it happens that way most of the time, it probably doesn't, but even if it only happened that way, it would still be sufficient.
Okay. And so in terms of, so to what I had in eighth grade, long story short, I hated God for several months. And then I had this moment where I watched a funny movie, and then I felt sorrow for my sin and I turned back to God. Mm-hmm. And for the longest time, you know, I began learning more about my faith, and, you know, I thought, well, it's because of this moment that, you know, that God, that proves that God is real and that he loves me. And I had always attributed to him. But recently I've noticed that, you know, I can't, because I know other, you know, religious people, they have their own experiences. And so when he said that faith can't come from the signs themselves, I started to freak out, plainly speaking, just because
that faith can't,
that's
what
I had always thought. It doesn't come directly from the miracle or the experience.
Well, no, but that's not the. I think you're misinterpreting what they're saying. They're not saying that it doesn't come from that. So remember, Jesus says, you know, you believe because you've seen my miracles, but blessed are those who believe but have not seen. Talking about faith that's not based upon evidence right in front of you. But both are valid. It's not as though your faith is somehow invalid because you had a powerful experience with evidence that heightened your faith or revived your faith. That's not what they're saying. In essence, though, what they're saying is that if it's just your own logical powers, if it's just your intellectual ability to reason your way toward certain truths, even if you reason your way correctly, in and of itself, that is not saving faith. That in itself can't save you. It's the supernatural gift that God gives, as you quoted in Ephesians 2, That's what is salvific. Now, everything else supports that, but it can't take the place of that. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Not really?
I think it does. Well, I think I'm getting there. So, in other words, you know, it doesn't, with or without evidence, faith is enough for salvation. But if we're trying to reason our way to the truth, yeah, we can know the truth, like the angel, like demons know the truth, but right. That isn't the same thing as getting that supernatural faith, which saves.
Right. So as St. James says, as you're alluding to in James 2, even the demons believe, but that's obviously not saving faith. They're incapable of being saved. Yeah, that's true. Just one little tweak, just so we don't wind up with a misunderstanding here. We're not saved by faith alone. That is a heresy. We're saved by grace alone, through faith and good works. So through faith, we appropriate the gift of God's grace by believing in him. And then we live out, as St. Paul says in Romans, the obedience of faith through good works. So faith is that first step that God enables us to take. And he's the one who enables, as it says in Ephesians 2, it's a gift. We can't even take credit for our faith. It's not as though God believes in himself and then pretends like you, Joseph, believed in him. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You actually have to have the faith. You, as an act of the will, it actually is a kind of work unto itself. It's an act of your will. But it's something that God enables you to do. And if you didn't receive that supernatural gift of faith, then you couldn't do it. And even if you were like, say, the demons, and you say, well, I do believe God exists, I do believe all these other things, but you don't have that act of faith and assent and submission, I guess we could say, then it would be sterile and it wouldn't be efficacious for salvation.
Mm-hmm.
You know who's got, did you say you had any background in Protestantism by chance, or were you always a Catholic?
I was born and raised Catholic. I was pretty lukewarm until about eighth grade, and then, you know, I had a period where I hated God. But then, you know, I watched it was a military comedy, and then I came to faith for real.
That's interesting. I'd like to recommend a book that I think you'll really be able to sink your teeth into. It's by Steve Wood, and the book is called Grace and Justification: An Evangelical's Guide to Catholic Beliefs. Now, I realize you were not an evangelical, but he explains this issue of the relationship between faith and good works and merit and justification and salvation and all the things that are associated with the question that you're asking. And he lays it out in a very biblical way. It's primarily for the benefit of non-Catholic folk who want to understand the Catholic teaching on grace and justification. But I have a feeling it will be a good fit for you. So maybe get that book, and I think it will help you cut through whatever remaining fog there might be on this issue.
Awesome. Thank you, Patrick, for your help. You have a good day. God bless.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. Yes, the name of that book, for those who didn't catch it first time around, is Grace and Justification, An Evangelical's Guide to Catholic Beliefs. Steve Wood's the author. And Steve Wood has no clue that I'm even mentioning this, but oh well. And we'll get a link to that posted so you can check it out for yourself at the show Twitter feed, at P Madrid Show, or just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
good vibes here on the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends. Send them a link to the relevant radio app so we can get everybody everywhere listening to this program and all the other programs too. I am going to take an email here that came in that deals with a delicate topic involving marriage. And I'm going to speak in a very generalized way. And I suspect all of you married folk will understand what I'm talking about here. It's an important question, and it's worth discussing, but it's not appropriate for children. Okay? So parents, if you've got teens on down, I would shoo them out of the room or just turn the radio off, down, whatever, for maybe 3 or 4 minutes. But it's important that you have this fair warning because it is a topic. It's worthy of discussion, but it will be a brief discussion and it will be roundabout. But it's also not something that you probably want your kids even thinking about. Okay? Cyrus, ready, steady, go. Fair warning. It sounds like me. Are you doing a Patrick Madrid impersonation there? Ready, steady, go. Fair warning. You're good. You're getting good at this, Cyrus. Okay, so and I'm also going to make sure that the email is it's completely anonymous. Okay, enough said. So a lady writes in, she says, and I'm going to sort of restate what she says in the email. She says that she's now in her 50s, she happily married, etc., but marital intimacy is not for her what it used to be, and this is because of changes in the female body, standard changes that all women go through. So nothing unusual there. And so her question has to do with the perfection of the act, meaning the act of marital intimacy between the husband and the wife. And some couples are able to conclude the act perfectly for both through the act itself. Some couples, or wives in this case, are not able to perfect the act without some additional assistance by the husband. And her question is that sinful in marriage? Is she doing something wrong, or is this something that is permitted? And so the answer to this question is it is permitted. The rule of thumb here is that whatever that in itself, obviously this is not referring to anything that would be a perversion or something that is clearly sinful or that would be going against the church's teaching on anything else. So we could rule out pornography, for example. That'd be something that is never, ever permissible. Rather, here we're talking about whatever actions between the husband and the wife that would bring the act to perfection, or would perfect the act. Now, in this context, to perfect the act, it means to complete it. It can also mean to make it as good as possible, but primarily it has to do with completion. So the word perfect as a verb, that's what the moral theologians are saying here. So simply put, I'll just leave it at this, that it is not sinful if, for whatever the reason may be, if the husband assists the wife in perfecting the act so that both of them have the fullest experience. And I think that I got my point across. Does that sound reasonably understandable, Cyrus?
Yes.
Okay, good. So there it is. It's an important topic. It's not something that you typically are going to hear on the radio, but there are ways to handle it so that it's not problematic, shall we say. And I do appreciate that kind lady writing in. I wonder if maybe a lot of other people may have the same question. Now, just as a, there was more I was going to say, but I don't think it's necessary. I think that's sufficient in itself. Hope that's helpful. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Monica in Tucson. Good morning, Monica.
Good morning. I'm actually in Chandler, but I just wanted to ask you a question. My nephew is going to be coming up to ASU this semester, and I wondered if you had any books that you would recommend for him as a gift. I want to keep him, you know, in his family, want to keep him in the Catholic Church, and I know it's tough through college.
Yeah, it's definitely tough through college. Well, yeah. Is he a reader? Because not everybody is.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he's definitely a reader.
Okay. Well, I would get him a few books. Number one would be Why Be Catholic? If you don't mind me recommending one of my own books. I wrote the book for that very reason, you know, for somebody who's
Catholic.
I actually
gave him that one already.
Very good. What was his reaction?
Well, he's got it on his bookshelf, so I think that's a good sign.
Okay, good. So he hasn't had a chance to dig into it yet. So that would be a good book. It would depend, of course, on what is the environment like, and is he experiencing challenges from a religious group, from an atheist professor? Is it the pro-abortion gender ideology idea? So that's where it would be a little more specialized. So if he's facing the onslaught of gender ideology, I would recommend either or both of these books, either When Harry Became Sally by Ryan Anderson or Irreversible Damage by Abigail Schreier. Both of those books are really helpful in understanding how to deal with people who are bound up in the gender ideology. That'd be one example. If it's a religious issue, I would turn to Catholic Answers for their materials. They've got lots of tracts and articles and things that you could give him or he could access for himself. I would recommend the Aquinas 101 series on YouTube that I like to promote, not for any benefit to me. There is no benefit to me, but I have benefited from it, and I think he would benefit as well. It's really clear, really cogent explanation of these bigger picture issues, and that's all free. Also, Father Mike Schmitz does a really great job on YouTube as well of breaking down specific topics that are pertinent to college students. So a lot of these resources are free and at your fingertips. I would encourage him to take a look at all of those.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome. And I hope he has a happy and successful college career. It's nice of you to be looking after him this way. Let's go to Fernando now in Albuquerque.
Hey, Patrick. Yes, my question was about the church's history. I have this question. I have these dots I want to connect. Okay. There's this guy on YouTube, for example. First of all, I know there's two sides of the story, and the church will have its story. But basically, he's, to make the story short, he's read many historical, old books, and he came to the conclusion that, you know, the church has gone into many wars and with the Bohemians, for example. You know, I just want to know the church's side. I just
okay, you're talking about John Huss?
I think so, yes. Think that he – and exactly, yeah. So I just want to know the other side of the story and – just make my own conclusion, I guess.
Sure.
But
easy.
Yeah.
Easy peasy, lemon squeezy. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. No problem. No, and the thing is, first of all, there's no need to stress out over these things. No need to stress at all. First thing to know, Fernando, is in the rearview mirror, as we look back on the history of the Catholic Church, there are plenty of things that are, by our judgment today, big problems that occurred, Catholics doing bad things or Catholics doing bad things for what they thought were good reasons. You know, burning people at the stake didn't happen as often as I think a lot of people think, but some of those things did happen. So don't be afraid of the fact that in Catholic history, you're going to find some dark chapters, and we should always just recognize them for what they are and take them into account with, you know, an even perspective in the sense of looking at all the evidence that's there. But don't let those things rattle you, first of all. John Huss, he was a member of, or at least he was maybe you might say the major figure in a movement known as the Hussites. And this was at the time of the Protestant Reformation, and Martin Luther and John Calvin and John Huss and all the others who were involved in this, they were running headlong into an established Christendom that had existed for over 1,000 years, in which you have the church and the state intimately connected, often in very good ways, sometimes in not so good ways. And so the problem is that you've got these kingdoms and principalities and nation states, not in the sense that we have them today, but when they saw the monarchs, for example, when they saw this mayhem and this division and, you know, verbal violence between these people who are promoting a new doctrine in the Catholic Church, very often they perceived that to be an attack upon the state itself. They perceived it to be an attack upon the civil order. Even though it was a religious argument, they were so closely associated with the church that the kings and princes and heads of these nations, they said, we've got to put a stop to this. So there was a lot of bloodshed that took place and a lot of people getting punished and even killed as a result of their opinions. How sad that is, right? But that's the way things worked in those days. We may not like it. We certainly may not want to do it that way nowadays, but that's how it was done then in Protestant countries, Catholic countries, etc. So we have to take that into account. What I would recommend is jump on the Catholic Encyclopedia online. You can access it at Catholic Answers, and their website is catholic.com. And just go and look under H for the article on John Huss and read it. It's free. You can get all the basic facts and figures and information from the Catholic perspective. And it's historically sound, it's accurate, and it will give you a lot of the details. And I would start there. Now, if you want to go deeper, and by the way, you can do this with Galileo or the Inquisition or the Cathari or the Albigensians or the Waldensians or all the different groups and people who are associated with some of these collisions with the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Encyclopedia online has got articles about all of them and plenty more besides. So that's all right there at your fingertips, and much of it is quite comprehensive, and it's free. But if you want to go deeper, I would suggest get the either the whole set or go volume by volume of Dr. Warren Carroll's Monumental History of Christendom. It's a powerful and very meticulously documented series of volumes on the history of the church, and all of these incidents are going to be well documented. He got his PhD in history from Columbia University. He was the founder of Christendom College. So he was a world-class scholar, a world-class historian, and he brought to bear those skills on this issue of the, you know, the 2,000-year history of the Catholic Church, and I believe it runs to about 7 volumes. So that's at the deep end of the pool, depending on how deep you want to go, Fernando, but that would be well worth your time if you did.
Yeah, I just want to answer to my Protestant brothers and even non-believers, you know, how to answer all those historical things, you know, and that's...
I thought I just gave an answer for that, though. I mean, these are places that will give you all those answers. Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to be difficult, but I'm saying it's easier than you might imagine. It's not as difficult as you think. I want to put your mind at ease.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Now, you're welcome. Before you go, though, is this fellow Protestant, or do you know what background he's coming from?
Well, a little short story about him. He spent 26 years in prison, and he read hundreds and hundreds of historical books. That's all he could do. And he's getting very popular on YouTube.
But my question is, does he come from a Protestant background, or is he just a secular guy?
Yeah, Protestant. Okay.
It's okay. It's okay. We don't need to go there. But the reason I ask that is there's another book that will give you a lot of answers to things like this, and that is called Catholicism and Fundamentalism by Carl Keating. And that is also a kind of a very important book in that genre. And there's a lot of history in it. It doesn't, I don't think, get into the issue of John Huss or anything, but it does get into some of the other heretical movements that the church had to deal with. And along the way, he debunks a lot of myths that people hold about such things as the Inquisition and so on. So that's another book I would encourage you to get. It's called, again, what is it called again? I just said it, Catholicism and Fundamentalism. And the author is Carl Keating. Keating. Well, I hope that helps, Fernando, and I'm glad to see that you want to take up the challenge and know the truth. And as Jesus said, the truth will set you free. Thank you. Let's take a break, and we'll come back to more of your phone calls right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester. This one's going out to the relevant radio engineers and technical people. The plant manager. This is for you. You know this song.
Oh, yeah. It's good stuff.
Welcome back, everybody. 888-914-9149. Remember I told you yesterday I had some good news, or at least potentially good news, turned into bad news, unfortunately. So Kansas voters yesterday overwhelmingly, this is according to NBC News, overwhelmingly struck down a proposed constitutional amendment that would remove language enshrining reproductive rights. Let's just call it what it is, abortion, killing unborn people. So in other words, the kind citizens of Kansas, at least the majority of them, did the wrong thing. And they voted to keep abortion legal in their great state. So that's what happened. And the forces of darkness prevailed, but only for a time. There will be other votes, and we'll see what happens. But in any case, that's what happened. I told you it was going to happen yesterday. It did happen, and that's what happened. I want to read you a letter that I ran across just the other day. In fact, I saw it on Reddit. And you know how on this program we get a lot of callers who are consternated about what's going on with the Latin Mass, or they're concerned, might be a light word for it. They're maybe angry, confused, demoralized about things that they see going on in the church. Well, you've heard me say before, we have to take a long view and realize that this little slice of life that we see in front of us, which to us is very momentous, of course, but that's just a little sliver of the bigger picture of the history of the Catholic Church that runs now to about 2,000 years. So this is not to in any way minimize what we're going through or say that it's nothing really to worry about. But then again, Jesus said, in the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world. And we're going to have difficulties in the church. It's always been that way. Seems like it's always been in more or less some state of uproar from the time of the 12 apostles until the present day. So it seems like that's the default position that the Lord, for whatever his reasons are, decided that his church would go through on a more or less continuous basis. And I can take some encouragement from that. I hope you can too. So all of this is just sort of a preamble to this little, I assume it's an excerpt from a letter that J.R.R. Tolkien, that one, yeah, that guy, J.R.R. Tolkien, he wrote a letter to his son. This is in the mid-1960s. And Vatican II had just unfolded, had just finished. And there was a lot of upheaval then, a lot of just crazy winds of division and disunity and departure from traditional Catholic teaching, etc., that were blowing mightily. A mighty wind blew through the landscape in those days. I remember it as a kid, and I certainly remember it by the time a few years later I was a teenager in the immediate aftermath. But it was a time of great upheaval. And so J.R.R. Tolkien wrote this as part of a letter that he wrote to his son about what was going on. So here's what he said. Trends in the church are serious, especially to those accustomed to find in it a solace and a pax, as in peace, in times of temporal trouble, and not just another arena of strife and change. But imagine the experience of those born, as I, between the golden and diamond jubilee of Queen Victoria. Both senses or imaginations of security have been progressively stripped away from us. Now we find ourselves nakedly confronting the will of God as concerns ourself and our position in time. I know quite well, he says, that to you as to me, the church, which once felt like a refuge, now feels like a trap. There is nowhere else to go. I wonder if this desperate feeling, the last state of loyalty hanging on, was not even more than it is actually recorded in the Gospels, felt by our Lord's followers in his earthly lifetime. I think there is nothing to do but pray for the church, the vicar of Christ, and for ourselves. And meanwhile, to exercise the virtue of loyalty which indeed only becomes a virtue when one is under pressure to desert it. That is so good. He could have written that this morning. Let me read that last line again. I think there is nothing to do but pray for the church, the vicar of Christ, and for ourselves. And meanwhile, this is the money quote if you ask me, and meanwhile to exercise the virtue of loyalty, which indeed only becomes a virtue when one is under pressure to desert it, as many people are nowadays, may I say to you.
That's beautiful.
Isn't that great?
Yep. And he attended Mass throughout the rest of his life. He never stopped. He was never discouraged. Well, he might have been discouraged, but he
never gave in.
He never gave up. Right.
Yeah, that's such an important thing. I mean, I've been talking about pray, and all the things that we're supposed to do. That's pro forma. But I think he really put, and that's no big surprise because after all, he's Tolkien. I'm just a guy with a microphone. But he put a real ribbon on top of this when he said, loyalty. Are you a loyal son or daughter of the church? Now, you may say, of course I'm a loyal son of the church. That's why I'm all riled about what's going on in the church. That's why I'm, you know, whatever your move to do or protest or whatever. But he's saying, especially you, if you say to yourself, I am the loyalest of the loyalist sons of the church. Well, it's all the more for you then. Because sometimes loyalty can wind up slipping into disloyalty under the guise of trying to be loyal. And we're called to be loyal not to our idea of the church or not to some notion of how things were in the glittering, hazy, golden past. Some things were better, but some things weren't. You know, the church wasn't a Mayberry RFD 50, 60 years ago. In some ways, I mean, it would have been much more pleasant and comfortable in a lot of the things that we see in the church's turmoil nowadays you wouldn't have seen then, but it wasn't a perfect situation then. And that's, I think that's what he's pointing out, is that this is the time, especially if you feel as though you've lost your bearings, you don't know what's going on in the church, why are bishops acting this way, why are these things happening? And well, I think this is a great bit of advice. Just be loyal. Don't turn against the church in her time of great difficulty. And it's not the first time of great difficulty, after all. Don't turn on her. Don't turn against her. Don't be disloyal. But as he says, pray. And I like the other thing that he said I thought was very telling. I don't know if this probably rang a bell for you too, where he says, our imaginations of security have been progressively stripped away from us. Now we find ourselves nakedly confronting the will of God as concerns ourselves and our position in time. If I can interpret what the great Tolkien is saying here, what he's saying is all of those things, all of the trappings of the Catholic faith that comforted you, and were good, you know, statues, banners, vestments, incense, Gregorian chant, whatever it is, and maybe other things besides. Ultimately, he's saying to his son, those things were stripped away from you, and really all you have left is what is God's will for you and what is God's will for the church. And if God is permitting the church to go through an upheaval like the Vatican Council, Second Vatican Council, well, God's will be done. That really speaks to me personally, and I wanted to share it with you. And you can get it. You don't have to go to Reddit to get it. You could, but it's easier if you just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. You'll find it there. Let's see. Let's go to Emily now in Bryant, Texas. Good morning.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question for you. My sister-in-law wants to have all the cousins come over, and I have a 6-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. She doesn't want the 1-year-old because she's not potty trained yet. And there's a total of 10 of them. Her boyfriend lives with her. I'm 99% sure. She won't come out and say it. But his house is on the market, and last I heard, he was. And so I was just curious, would you let your young kids go over there for a weekend?
No.
Okay, thank you. That's exactly what I was thinking. Can I have...
I wouldn't do it for a variety of reasons. to have a young man who's not known to me, who's already breaking some important rules in a sexual way, and to have little kids under the same roof with in essence a stranger, not happening. I would never do that.
Now, can I add a quick question to the end?
Sure, sure.
My husband mentioned that to his mother yesterday, and a little bit of backstory: when we were dating, when we would go stay the weekend with his parents, she would put us in the same room. Now, nothing happened, but I was young and dumb. I should have, you know, gone to the couch, or my husband should have, looking back.
Right.
Well, when he mentioned this, she called him or us hypocrites, saying it was pretty hypocritical of us to do this. How would you respond without damaging that relationship?
Well, just between you and me, I would be tempted to say something that I wouldn't say out of respect. But I'd say, if you think we're hypocrites, you're foolish, because you're the one who put us in this room together. It's amazing to me that nothing happened, Emily. So kudos to you and your then boyfriend. It's very unusual that nothing happened. But thank God.
But
she was the architect of, talk about an occasion of sin. She was the architect of that. So
right.
she doesn't really have a lot of room to be rebuking you when she's the one who was the cause of it in the first place. But
yeah.
I wouldn't, you know, I mean, obviously you want to be respectful, honor your father and mother and all of those things. So I'm not suggesting otherwise. But at the same time, I couldn't care less if she thinks that you're a hypocrite because you don't want your kids to go over there, because it's two different things. Number one, you were, I'm assuming, probably older teenagers, right, when you were over there?
Yes. I mean, okay. young adults, like, yes.
Okay, so young adults, even more. So you were young adults. These are little kids. So that's another aspect of it. So these are little kids. They're defenseless. They don't have any. It's not like when you're 20 and you can get up and walk out of a room or whatever. They can't do that, at least not easily. So it sounds to me like she's got a couple of problems with her, maybe more than a couple, but she's got some problems with the way in which she raises children. And it sounds as though there's some bad judgment going on there for whatever reason. But if she says that to you, you're a hypocrite, you could bite your tongue and smile and say, okay, God bless you if you think we're hypocrites, but we're not letting the kids come over.
Okay, that's probably the route I'm going to take. I have kind of a temper, so I don't want to.
Yeah. But you can always tell her. But that guy on the radio thinks that you're the hypocrite because you're the one rebuking the kids for something you did. But you don't have to tell her that.
Well, my husband, you know, that's what he said. They didn't grow up going to church. They never had a strong religious foundation.
Who's they?
It's him and his siblings.
Oh,
he's
I
one
see.
Of seven. And when she said we did it in front of her kids. Her youngest was 12.
When you did what?
But they, well, when we would go in the same room, when she
oh,
would,
I see.
When
yeah,
we
it's
would
scandalous.
Come over for the weekend.
Scandalous. It was dangerous for the two of you, morally dangerous. But you didn't commit a. Well, I suppose that you wound up participating in what was scandalous. But sounds like you didn't have much choice because his mom was telling you guys go sleep in that room, and so the other siblings.
And, you know,
saw that and
then mm-hmm. And looking back, I should have known better, but like I said, I was young, and in college I was not as faithful to the Catholic faith as I should have been. Mm-hmm. You know, and so looking back, yes, but I'm just trying to go forward. I would like it to be different with my kids.
Absolutely. So maybe your message in an overt or maybe more implicit sense could be to your mother-in-law, you know, we're not going to make those same mistakes. We learned from some of those mistakes and we don't want to make them again. So we're not going to put the
right.
kids in a situation where they could be even remotely at risk. We're just not going to do it.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
And you know, one thing comes to my mind, Emily, one reason why she might be antagonized by this is because you're prompting her conscience. And maybe at some level she realizes that what she did was not right or it was foolish. And the fact that you're standing up and saying, we're not going to do that, is a rebuke to her conscience. And that may be the source of why she's irritated with you over this.
Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah, it's just kind of a shock response, but yes.
Yeah, well, I hope that this has a happy ending. Sounds like it will. Sounds like you and your husband are going to be doing the right thing. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Kip now in Easton, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Kip.
Good morning, Patrick. In Scripture, we're told that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And our hope is in the Lord. And I know as Catholics, we don't pray to the saints. We don't worship and adore the saints like we reserve that for God.
Right.
But I'm confused, and I'm hoping you can help me, because in the prayer, Hail Holy Queen, Mother of Mercy, our life, mm-hmm. our sweetness, and our hope, why are we calling the Blessed Virgin Mary our life and our hope when clearly Jesus, God, is our life and our hope?
That is such a good question, Kip. I wish I had taken your call a little sooner because I don't have time to answer it properly. So do you mind holding, and then on the other side of the timeout, I'll come back to you and we'll take it from there?
I tell you what, if you'd just respond on the other side, I have to hang up and I'll listen on the radio.
Got it. Okay. Stay warm and well fed, Kip. Good to talk to you, and I will respond to that very good question on the other side of this timeout. So please, everybody, don't go away, because I'm going to tell you how to answer that question right after this.
Hey, there's a line open, so now is your opportunity to ask Patrick a question by calling 888-914-9149.